What's up, long players? Welcome to the Long Play Listening Party, the show where we go deep on local music, making records, music gear, and whatever else sounds good to us. I'm Howie Howard. We've got Royce Diamond on the line. What's up, Royce?
How we doing?
And our guest, Rob Spector from Brooklyn, New York. How's it going, Rob?
Yo, Howie and Royce, how are y'all doing down in the Sunflower State? It's great to catch up with you for this listening party.
Royce is on the Missouri side, I believe.
Oh, is
he? No, I'm on the Kansas side.
I apologize for that deep offense, sir. I understand. That's like fighting words in that part of the country.
Is your studio on the Missouri side, though, downtown?
Yeah, my studio downtown is over on the Missouri side.
Okay. Wow. Wow, I really stepped in it. I understand that's a source of great friction.
Well, not in this room.
Fair enough, fair enough.
There you go.
Well, it's great to hang out with you both. Howie, obviously you and I have known each other for years, but Royce, this is the first time that I get to put a face to the excellent music I've heard so far, so it's great to meet you.
Oh, man, I appreciate you. Thank you. Yeah, it's great meeting you. Yeah.
Cool. So we are here. Oh, sorry, Royce. I was just saying, we're here to talk about a record that Rob and I made. Rob's record.
It was our record.
Got the shaft.
We both worked on it.
Record's called A Life Without Fireflies. Recorded in 2003. The mix took until 2005. The release took until 2008. And we're celebrating. That record's been on my website. It's been on archive.org. We're going to put it on Bandcamp and on the streaming platform. So by the time you're seeing this show or hearing this show, we're going to have it on Bandcamp and Spotify and YouTube and Apple Music and Tidal and all that kind of stuff. So that's the reason behind talking about this old record at this point in time.
You know, from writing to recording to release, I think we can safely say it took the entirety of the Bush administration. Some of the first songs were indeed written in the first year of the Bush administration, and the recording happened at the end of the first term, and we did get it out right before W left office. So it's
not the measuring stick I would have gone to first, but apt. And honestly, listening back, I mean, the Bush administration looms large over this record in some ways. And in some of those ways, still feels very relevant.
And that's kind of the astonishing thing, right? You make a record like this, and you know, we were both a lot younger than we are now. And you know, we made this record in Nebraska in 2003, which was a period in the American culture wars that felt very very close, right? Because we had just gotten whooped on the first Defense of Marriage Act. We just had midterms that absolutely did not go the way that we were expecting them to go in Nebraska. The first anti-Iraq occupation protests had just started. You and I both marched in those, and it was a heavy time. It felt like, you know, for being in the middle of the country and, you know, being in a place where, you know, you don't often see in the New York Times or you see in a lot of the national news, the pressing political influences of the time felt very, very much in our neighborhood. And I do think that was a significant part of at least the writing process, indeed. Some of the recording process too.
Word. So let's give Royce. So Royce is coming in cold. He hasn't heard the record.
Oh man.
Rob.
Well, Royce, thanks for donating your night.
Rob, tell, you know, for Royce and for people who haven't heard it, how would you begin to describe this record?
You know, it's a tough one. I think, I had the good fortune of meeting Howie at a Hugh O'Brien Youth Leadership event, of which we were both alums when we were in high school. And I think that's when we first met. And I found out he played guitar, and he in fact brought a guitar, and he let me play his guitar, and we played some songs, and
we were guitar guys.
And by virtue of that meeting, I got to fall in, or I had the good fortune of falling in with a group of folks in the middle of Nebraska that were making music that really spoke to me in a meaningful way and didn't sound like anything else that you would hear on the radio or was popular at the time. And, you know, because we were the only people doing that sort of thing in the part of the country that we were doing it in, we had to depend on each other in a lot of ways to play shows and build audiences and ultimately what I think was, you know, the genesis of forming Mr. Furious Records was to try to document this kind of nascent scene of all the people that we'd surrounded ourselves with. So being able to play shows with you and Scott under Howling Scott, being able to play with Shacker and a lot of these other bands that were kind of germinating in this tiny, tiny scene. I felt really compelled to make a record that covered all this, mostly because I was surrounded by all of you, and that ended up being A Life Without Fireflies.
Let's hear some of it.
How's that supposed to help? I'm just saying what you're too afraid
of. About finding an answer, which, you know, I don't know, okay? I just always live my life without fireflies.
As I recall, that was an SM58 into my mom's phone. That was not like affected. Like we actually just shut.
That was real. That was a real phone.
This may be one of the only guitar solos I've ever recorded, by the way.
I see you sitting there so civilized, investing stocks in earth but still no silent dreams up in the sky. Some stupid shallow succubi singing songs of lovesick lullabies, but in the middle like a riddle I can see something I can recognize. Silent sparkle in a sea of floodlights, camouflaging in plain sight, blue shifting as a beeline.
I love the drums on this, man. You really found it here.
My chops are up back then.
Sitting safe and soft like a faint and distant star. I see you not as you wanna be, but as you already are. Admiration chased in from afar.
I do regret the guitar tone. That was coming out of a Fender Frontman amp. Like a solid state, right, like practice amp at the time. Wish we could bounce.
What was for that. I can see your guitar online, but it's black and red. I can't remember what it was.
Oh, the guitar was a ES-335 knockoff from the late 70s called a Hondo. It was like a Sears Roebuck catalog number that my granddad gave me. But it had legit humbuckers in it that were installed later, and so it actually sounded okay.
Sounds pretty good.
But the amp was not top shelf.
Royce, first impressions?
Say what?
I was asking Royce what his first impressions were. Oh, he's muted. He might be. He likes to get his speakers up.
Oh, I'm
really probably. Really let it wash over, you know.
Drop in. I hear it.
Sorry about that.
No worries.
No, it was great. I was listening to the music and listening to you guys talk about it.
Cool. So yeah, you got to keep in mind, we're 21, 22.
Yeah, we're very young. And this is like, is this like the fifth or sixth MFR record at this point?
It's catalog number 25, but that's because of the you know, the long delay in getting it released. It was recorded.
In terms of recording, this is pretty early.
It's very early. I got. We've talked about this rig like four shows in a row. I got the Digi 01 Thanksgiving of 2002.
Oh wow!
And immediately. That so spring 03, summer 03 recorded this record, Shackers, Pardon My Pretension, and Howie and Scott Signs and Comments.
Wow.
Where were
we? Oh
wow, at?
So we were, this was after the Shacker record, but before Signs and Comments.
All in those ish. The first 6 months of 2003. So it was, wow. So it actually the recording predates MFR.
Wow.
And where did you do? Where were you physically recording this?
My mom and dad's, the house I grew up in.
Okay.
Yeah, wow. We did a week in his parents' basement, and we did a week in my mom's basement.
In Medicine Lodge.
Yeah, in Medicine Lodge, Kansas, like middle of nowhere. Something like you had to drive like 9 hours to get there. Creed.
Wow.
Yeah. He met me at Hastings because I had just graduated and I loaded all my stuff up and then we drove down to finish this out. I think by the time we made it to Medicine, we had your drums, we had bass, we had some guitars, and a couple of the, like, there were some synth lines that I remember. I'm not sure if they ended up making it in the record or not, but I think we did the synth stuff at the Howard residence, if I remember.
And how many people? How many people?
Oh, it's just him and me.
Basically, my friend Scott did a couple little overdubs, but it's basically.
Oh, that's right. He did do a thing on one song. That's right. Which were dope. Had a good thing. Watch the sunset from Galway
Bay. We'll go through the Louvre, act only for. I don't remember. Rob, did you have demos or scratch tracks, or what did I drum to? How did we get started?
Yeah, I did have some scratch tracks that I did in. It'll remind us of. It wasn't Audacity. And it wasn't Pro Tools. There was some janky, cheap software that I recorded it in my dorm room.
And, like Cakewalk.
Yeah. Can't remember what it was, but that's what you drank. That's what you drummed to. We tried to do a click track for a while, and then we just accepted. We accepted my musicianship in that moment.
Was that always the workflow? Like, Rob, you'd start with something and then bring it to Howie? Or how did it always work?
Howie was acting out of, like, pure charity participating in this record. I didn't have a touring band. I usually played by myself, or I had another guitar player playing with me at the time. And we really wanted to get these songs on wax. And he, you know, generously, you know, produced it, but also, you know, wrote the drum tracks and a lot of other parts of a lot of the other songs. So it was very much a collaborative effort, but it wasn't a circumstance where we were planning on touring behind it, or like building a band behind it, or anything like that.
Yeah, we never performed these songs in this kind of like fully fleshed out. This is just a studio creation.
Yeah.
The Shaft live show was Rob and a rotating cast of guitarists and bassists, and sometimes I'd play some hand drums and kind of whoever we could lay hands on.
Yeah, yeah. Most of the time when we would play live, it would be me opening for Howie and Scott, or it'd be us opening up, or I would open up for Shacker, or it'd be us opening up for someone else. you know, we were, it was tough to find places to play when you're playing this kind of music at that time. Because
I was going to ask you, where were you playing?
We were playing, I mean, literally, we would show up for the opening of a wound, Royce. Like, we would go anywhere that would have us. Every coffee shop in Nebraska. Yeah. We became very good friends. Yeah, we became very good friends with everybody that managed like student entertainment budgets and liberal arts schools in the area.
Got you.
Those are paydays.
Yeah. Oh, we played a gay bar in Lawrence, Kansas one time. It was set up by a guy who was playing bass for me at the time. They did not like it at all. they were not into it at all. We had a great time. They were kind of more interested in something they could dance to. But, I mean, we'd just show up anywhere where we could play, triply. And, you know, all the bands that were really popular at the time that were, like, local bands were all playing, like, kind of, like, new metal stuff. Because this is when, like, Korn and Limp Bizkit are going big. Gotcha. Or they were playing, like, kind of hard rock stuff. Because at the same time, you have, like, System of a Down and A Perfect Circle and Tool. And, like there was just not, there's not a lot of folks that were kind of playing the kind of music that we were playing. So you just kind of took the gigs where you could find them.
Running from nothing, she's running, she's running, she's running, she's running, she's running, she's running, and cultural clash and shyness match.
I forgot about this song. I'm not sure I'm over the moon on it, truthfully.
So this is a good opportunity to say that I think I haven't given you enough props for bass playing on this record. The bass playing on this is pretty melodic. It drives the songs forward. It's nice counterpoint, you know, and I don't know how much of that was planned out and practiced or just kind of done on the spot, but, you know, the combination, the drums and the bass, you know, really kind of put this on a... They keep it moving forward, you know?
Mm. Well, I did play bass in a lot of bands growing up, so I felt like it certainly I feel more comfortable playing bass than I do playing lead guitar. I'm a rhythm guitarist, like that's what I do. But if I was gonna pick up a second instrument, it would probably have four strings rather than six. Oh, I remember this one.
Good one.
He never thought he'd be saved by somebody.
This one's a jam.
Within an inch of life, that turning colorblind with open eyes. Father looks out at his son, introducing him to his special someone. Normally, he called them fags, but one of them calls him dad, so where they stand, intense friction. His son was his pride and joy. How could he turn his back on his only boy? It only took a year, but they're talking civilized with open eyes. It only took him a year, but now he sees with open eyes. A teenage boy meets a girl. Can't afford that diamond, so he gave her a pearl. But he was Muslim, she was Jew. On top of that, she's pregnant too, and the war was threatening their world. Well, those planes came and they dropped their bombs. Suddenly their parents figured out how to get along. Oh, how this world could change when you start to pick your sides with open eyes. This world can't change if you look with open eyes.
The lyrics are really good. I mean, this is the kind of thing, it could be heavy-handed, but it's not. It's driven by characters. even in just a few short lines, you know, the characters are not caricatures. They're complex, you know, and this is a really good one, Rob.
This is really good.
Yeah, I was happy with how this one came out.
Do you remember writing it?
Yeah, it was, I think it was the night after we got the results of the DOMA decision, and we just got wrecked. So the very first Defense of Marriage Act, the very first, like, statewide amendment banning gay marriage was in Nebraska, because Nebraska had a unicameral legislature. So the whole conservative plan to, you know, ban gay marriage nationally started in Nebraska because we had this unique legislature that no one else had. And, you know, spent a lot of time working on it. I spent a lot of time canvassing, spent a lot of time marching, spent a lot of time, like, doing, you know, phone polling and stuff like that, and just getting lit up all the time. And, you know, we invested a ton of time and treasure into trying to defeat it, and we just got smacked in the mouth. Like, we lost by like 60 points or something ridiculous. It was like 83% yes versus 17% no or something like crazy. It was, we just got destroyed. And it really, that was really the impetus to write a song that tried to, I knew eventually everybody that made that decision to vote yes that day was going to ultimately regret it, because they were going to encounter someone they loved that was directly affected by those decisions. And so I ended up writing a song that kind of captured not just that, but a lot of the other inequities that I think are common to, you know, living in that part of the world.
Wow, I wish I'd have been that deep at 21.
I don't know about how deep that was, dude. Back to sleep. I mean, solid state distortion does not sound that deep. Many respects, that guitar effect may be representative of, you know, the full the full scope of my philosophy. Sad one.
Waiting for the doctor to call, she cuddles close to me as the phone rings, and then she tries not to bawl, and she looks up to me with a smile in her eyes, and I reciprocate. She gets on the phone to call all her friends, and I don't know what to say, so I whisper, I love you too.
I think I sequenced the album. This is something I would do, is put this at the end of side one. You know, pretty classic sequencing there.
Yeah. It's funny having this drop, listening to this in 2020, which is, you know, when you don't have a side one anymore, and you really have to, you know, basically you're keeping the listener in the first two songs, or you're not, right? Like, where you would put the song in 2020 is very different than where you'd put it back then. It's wild. We can't save her. I think it belongs where it is. Because just looking at the waveform of the rest of the record, it's like, and then and then
she takes, and I don't know. It does look that way. The loud songs are not that loud. They're not loud by 90s or 2000 standards, but
this is not a criticism of the mix or the master, Howie. This is reflective of my personality, I think. Which is either, you know, I'm either at 10 or I'm at 2. Like, I'm never...
Gotcha.
I'm never, like, you know, there's not, like, a mid-tempo song in this whole thing, unless I'm doing a breakdown.
Only Way is kind of mid-tempo.
Oh, that's fair. That's fair.
Exception that proves the rule.
Fair.
I hear the voice of my girl, and I look up with a smile in my eyes, but I can't see a thing. Her soft, sweet voice kisses my ear, and I don't know what to say. So I whisper, I love you too.
Yeah, that happened. That was
So, Royce, you can tell by now, like, we didn't fit in the bars, you know, we didn't fit in the clubs, you know, we had to find places to play music like this.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't really drinking music, you know? When he came
to me, it was a sad sight to see. Yeah, it's kind of wild. But listening to this now, I do have to register a certain gratitude to the music department at Hastings College, because I was a music major, but they kept roping me into, like, men's chorus and, like, a whole bunch of, like, the jazz chorus and stuff like that. And listening to my voice here compared to when you and I met Howie, it had a significant difference. Like, it really, I think it really improved my singing, and hearing it now, I wonder if I have that level of discipline today. I bet I don't.
Did you have a sparkly vest?
Back then, yeah, I had a sparkly vest. I said, talk to you later. Why make me wait here? It's a good lyrical reference there.
Yeah, that's a great line. Which is Baker's intro. I stood at that bus station and I couldn't answer him, because a moment had locked in our minds and my heartbeat kept the world in time. Because just when I thought that I'd seen everything that could be, something transcended me.
So you recorded this in 2003.
Yeah.
You mixed it in 2005. Continued the march,
each step seeming. Yeah, so I'll put a link to the liner notes, which are extensive in the show description or whatever. But so we recorded in spring and the first week of summer 2003. And I tried to mix it. I was recording two other albums at the same time that summer. I was working full time, and I was getting ready to go to Ghana in the fall for my semester abroad. And so it was a really busy time, and we didn't get to a satisfactory mix before I left for Ghana. Rob moved to Rhode Island, what, the day after we finished recording?
Yeah, yeah. You left. You left at like 8, and then I left at noon.
So you started kind of your whole adult life. I had this crazy senior year of college. When I came back, I was putting out my own record. And so we were both just super busy, and the mixing was not going well. I was doing too much. Royce, I mean, you'll know. You know, I just kept EQing and EQing, and it was getting worse. You know what I mean? So then a couple of years go by. Rob's in Rhode Island with a new band playing these songs, and I hear the the last mixes that I did on his MySpace page, and they sound terrible to me. And so
on my MySpace page.
Yeah, right.
for the kids, that was Facebook before Facebook.
That's right.
Yeah.
We did have a MySpace page. Oh my goodness.
The mixes sound bad, and I just think I can't let Rob be out here letting people hear these mixes. So I took just an afternoon. I took off all the plugins and all the processing and just went quick, right? And just did a quick mix of the punk songs, the faster, you know, electric songs. And just like sent them off that night. Just like, here, put these on your MySpace page. They may not be perfect, but they're better than, you know, the last thing I did. And actually, as we listened to them, they sounded pretty good. And then I think I remixed this song, Something Transcendent. And we picked the best of the 2003 mixes for a couple of the quieter songs. And then we were just kind of waiting around for 3 more years for a reason.
That's why I was super wondering.
We just kind of never found the moment to put it out until finally Chinese Democracy was finally coming out. Guns N' Roses is a long-awaited record.
Yes.
And I sent you a snarky email that was just like, hey, Rob, do you want to stick it to Axl and put Fireflies out on the same day as Chinese Democracy? And you were like, yes.
I'm like, we're doing it.
We're finally doing it.
So you mixed them and mastered them.
Yeah, it was the same day as Chinese. I think it was every bit as successful. I think it was heard by as many people.
So after the songs were done, you just kind of sat on them?
Well, it was wild because, I think part of the timing, if we would have released it before Signs and Comets went out, I think it would have been fine. But when Howie was talking about the record he was working on, that was not merely a Howie and Scott record. That was not merely a Howie record. That was like a double CD magnum opus for that musical project. Like, Signs Comets was legit, probably the most complete musical expression out of all of us in that scene at that time. Like, it was a huge accomplishment, and it was consumptive, right? Like, it very obviously took a lot of time, and you know, once it came out, you got to promote it, you got to play shows, and he was also, you know, going through the same thing I had just gone through the year previous, which is like graduating college and starting your life is is a big transition, and it's one that I don't think I afforded enough. I did not provide enough affordance for how much that was going to take to like get my career like going. And I don't know if that was the same for you, Howie, but I imagine that definitely played a role in that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the specifics were very different as far as you're starting a career and I'm traveling and finishing up college and all this stuff. By the way, I hear I made a mistake in my show prep for you guys. We're hearing the same song twice. I'll figure out what to do in the show edit. Sorry about that. But I guess to me, the reason it didn't come out is much more that I was mixing poorly. And you may not feel the same, but I felt, you know, that thing about reach and grasp, and I just could not make the mixes sound the way I wanted them to and the way I thought they deserved to sound. And, I was brand new. I was working on a brand new system. I was new to all of this. It was my first time recording myself. It was my first time mixing records that I'd recorded, and my ambitions were just a mile high.
Well, and I think my ambition was that high too, but similar that like your ambition for production was like this high and your technical ability was this high. My musical ambition was this high, but my musical ability was like about three stories south of Fraggle Rock. Like it was not in a great place. And there was a simpler version of these songs. There was a funner version of these songs that I think could have happened. But there was, I think there's a struggle with anyone who is making a record. You know, all the records I made before then didn't feel like I had the right personnel or the right like possibility in the time to really do it well. This one felt like I really had it, and I didn't know if I was going to get it again. And so I think I kind of shoved it, especially from a songwriting standpoint, I think I kind of shoved too much ambition into a small jar, where I think if I maybe had kind of reined my horses a little bit and just tried to, instead of having like 12 ideas, if I would have had 5 ideas on the record, it would have been better overall.
I don't know. That would be a very different album, right? To me, the whole Fireflies as a phenomenon to me is all about this reaching and this overstuffing and this, you know, just absolutely swinging for the fences, and, you know, and probably hitting like a triple, maybe, you know, and that's part of what I love about it now. At the time, maybe it felt like a compromise, or it was frustrating, or, but honestly, I've come to learn, you know, 100 records deep into all this, basically every record's like this, right? Like it never, you put it out and you move on, and it's never quite as good as you hoped, maybe. Or maybe that's just me, but for me now, it's much more about the personal best than achieving every last bit of what I set out to achieve, because I just never really get there.
You know, it kind of brings up a good thing, and I'd be interested, Royce, in how you feel about this. Like, one thing I found post-Fireflies, like post-making this record, having done a few records since, being in a lot of bands since, is, you know, when you're making music, you have to wade through all this garbage in order to do what you want to do, right?
Yeah.
But there are like 3 dials in your life as a musician that keeps you going. And one of them is the writing, like the composing. One of them is the performing. And one of them is the recording. And I think a thing that I didn't really understand then that I've since learned about myself is that, like, I love the writing part. I love the performing part. And the recording part, I've just never gotten the same satisfaction out of it. The sense that I get from you, Royce, from what I've heard, and certainly from my long experience of working with you, Howie, is you guys love the recording piece. How do you feel about the performing and the writing piece? Like, is it that relative, or is it actually, do you get a kick out of all 3 similar?
The thing that's most fulfilling for me is writing. I feel like that's what, it's like my zen space. It's where I work out all of my, I learn how I feel and who I am in my writing. I do enjoy, and honestly, I enjoy mixing way more than I enjoy recording. But
really?
Yeah, I feel like, I always just feel like there's a lot of pressure, and there's always just something that I didn't quite get exactly the way that I wanted it. I haven't mastered recording the way I wish I could, but like, man, I can mix a song 3-4 times without very much effort anymore, and I just love it. I can just get in there and dial in and try something new, and it either works or it doesn't. And I used to get, like, if I, for whatever reason, I'd get married to an idea and just go off the rails with it. The thing I, and I don't perform much anymore, but the thing I really loved about performing was, you know, I'd create something that I thought was genuine, unique, and just like extremely dope. And I get to go out and see how other people feel about it. But yeah, I think for me, everything comes in cycles. Like there are some times where like I'm just on fire writing, and then other times I would never let anybody look in my notebook. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and you know, and it's like that with all other aspects of my creativity, I think. There are just times where I'm like in the zone with one particular thing, which is really why this record's impressive. You know, two guys, you guys did a lot. Just two guys, and you're like, but my expectations were way up here. Like it was 50 of you, you know what I mean? Wow. Like making a record is really, really hard. If you go into a pop studio, there are like 30 people standing around. It's like a factory, you know what I mean? And two guys showed up and put together an album in 2 weeks. Is that what you're telling me? Like most of this record was put together in 2 weeks.
All of it was 2 weeks.
All of it?
It was 14 days.
Yeah.
Because that's all we had.
On a Digi 001 with like one gig of RAM, something like that.
Yeah. Listen, it crashed all the time. Like people using Pro Tools now don't understand. Like
we right?
Every take, every punch, everything was like save, and then like every third time, Howie would be like, I'm just gonna restart Pro Tools. I'm just gonna close Pro Tools and I'm gonna restart it just to make sure we don't lose, you know, a performance. And we lost a crap load of performances. Like we lost a ton of them.
Yeah, those sessions
nothing that I thought we didn't ultimately get back, but it was a very different time. Recording digitally was not as reliable as it is today.
No, and it didn't sound as good. You know, this is impressive. You did this in a Digi 001 in 2003.
Yeah. This
sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, shout out to Howie's parents, by the way. They were incredibly hospitable. And they were all, like, I know that... Did you make the Shaka record in your basement?
This was all, I mean, it's not even, so all that stuff we recorded at my house was recorded on the main floor. Drums in the kitchen, my mom's kitchen.
Yeah.
Other stuff, you know, computer, vocals, guitars, and we had a spare room with a piano in it, you know, that was kind of the music room, but the family music room. It wasn't mine, you know, it was family computer, family piano.
Yeah. Got, like his old man is like reading the newspaper while we are like,
my parents were incredibly supportive.
They were so cool. Like they were so supportive. I mean, like not just cool, like tolerating it. They were like very obviously supportive. And like Mama Howie, like we had a great dinner one night and had a great conversation that I recall, and it was super fun. A fun story that I didn't remember until we were prepping for this podcast and Howie shared it with me. I absolutely got pulled over right in front of their house when I went in to record this record. Like
as you pulled up first night.
As I pull up, there is a Crete police officer right behind me. And apparently I had a taillight out. So I got to fix a ticket, which I 100% never paid or actually fixed. So I bet there's a bench warrant for me out in that county now. I've seen the goal behind the glitter. She's still a princess to me. Oh, wow. I forgot this tune. I've never seen
that look before. She's never so pissed at me. I remember using the Pro Tools half-speed record trick for the bass.
Oh, that's right. I couldn't do it fast enough.
I was thinking, wow, that's really fast.
I thought, I failed, I thought of her. She's still a princess to me.
And why did you put the drums in the kitchen?
That's what we had. Nice wood floor, you know.
Oh, I got you.
There weren't a lot of options. But listen, it was loud. It was loud as hell, Royce. Like, it was really just...
I can still feel in my body the stress and anxiety I felt. We spent the first 3 days tracking drums, and I thought I could knock them out in like a day or something. Because we plan to make the record in 1 week.
Yeah.
We're going to try and do it all over spring break.
Oh, man.
And so, you know,
you guys have some pretty lofty goals.
it was way too lofty. And I remember that I can still feel in my chest what it felt like on day three, knowing that time is slipping away. I'm beating myself up. I'm not, you know, playing up to what I was hoping to play. And everyone, Rob's just been sitting around for 3 days watching me play drums. Like, he's not even getting to work on his own record. Like, the physical sensation of anxiety for me goes back to those moments.
Well, also, like, I'm also...
entirely self-imposed. Like, I did that to myself.
Yeah, it was self-imposed. Because I'm also hearing these songs with a real kit player, basically for the first time. And it was so rad. Like, I was so over the moon on how this turned out. And I think the... I think one of the exchanges that you and I had in that first week was, I think I made the statement to you, something to the effect of, songwriters make the best drummers, and in every band that I've had ever since then, I've always made sure that the drummer is also a songwriter, because they just always know what to do in a way that a drummer who doesn't write songs doesn't have.
Had you guys had that conversation before? Like, just how you were feeling sitting there through that week? Stepping up and
go to sing my... I don't remember.
I could tell you were tense. I don't think we talked about it, though. I think I was more... I was more in a space where I felt like we would find a way... If we didn't get it done that week, we'd find a way to get it done before you went to Ghana. And that might require me, you know, coming back to Crete or... And we ultimately decided to have you come down to Medicine. But we would... I was pretty confident we were going to figure out how to figure it out. And I also didn't feel like we were... We were not looking at another 3 weeks of recording. Right? Like, I knew we were... It was a project that always felt like we were 2 days away from being finished. Which is a dangerous place for a project to be. But I did think it was realistic. Well, you
and me were getting... I was probably just... I barely remember it. But as far as conversations go, but I was probably just, like, head down, like, tightening up, you know, just, like, just give me another, you know, one more take. I can do, you know, one more...
So, what did the recording process look like?
Probably the way to get the best performance out.
What did that recording process look like? I mean, if you're playing the drums, so you mic'd up the kit?
Mic'd up the kit. I mean, I did everything probably for the first 3 days, right? I mean,
yeah,
I mic'd the drums.
Totally. Yeah.
I'm clicking the Pro Tools. I'm jumping over to the kit. I play a take.
Oh, really?
Back.
Well, I would hit the red button.
Okay.
Okay.
I did man the mouse. and successfully restart Pro Tools several times. Oh, wait. We got your thing. Oh, you dropped the Ghanaian poem in here, right?
This is a little Ghanaian, like, folk song, or almost like a kid's song. It's, that I learned on my first trip. It's, if they ask of me, tell them I come from Ghana. And in Ghana, you'd sing your village name. I've tried but I sang it as Ghana.
With a grin, I say it's good when you're
yeah, that was fun. That was a fun little audition.
Life is too short to take it so seriously. One time a laugh and then we'll try to see. One more time we'll
yeah, not a great song, but good drop to have that in there.
Good sequencing, as we'll see for a second. Yeah. The bass slide into Hey Gordon Shumway gives me so much joy. That half second of audio. And I want to make sure, so it's coming up in about 30 seconds, and I want to make sure we let it play. In a way, the whole record's worth it to me just to have the first four bars just make me so happy. Scott's bongos.
Yeah, right? That's good. There we go. Yeah, this is the closer on all the shows. It was always the funnest song to play. Yeah, I still love this tune.
I saw him staring at the screen. I was 9,316. He was pissed and he wanted to know how the whole world bent on a few men say so. He said, hey man, it never bothered me. Would you like to see how I can make the cap pee green? He said, hey yo man, no problemo, but there are a few things that you ought to know. Don't believe everything that can breathe.
The guitars sound great on this. Even the electric to me sounds great on this one. The way it combines with the acoustic together, they sound huge.
Yeah, yeah. I think we got the guitar tone out of the entire record. This is where we got the guitar tone most dialed in.
Was that lyric, don't believe everything you read, I think it's better for you to think?
Don't believe everything that you breathe. There's a few things more important than
fingernail hygiene.
Fingernail hygiene. In fact, back in Mel Mac Jack, we don't believe in that. So the whole song is about Alf, by the way. That's Gordon Shumway's name. It's all about Alf from
the little alien guy.
Yeah, the little alien 90s puppet comedy.
I see a world philosophy that's bent on keeping all the guys that are like me down. They always push us to the brink, they call us geeks. There's nothing left in this world for me. Hey Gordon Shumway, what does a guy like you see when you look at me? Is there a geek existentially, or is the world full of a bunch of MIBs? We're planning a scene where everybody unique is jumping to the same heart.
I totally ran out of breath there.
And we left it in. We didn't know how to punch. And
it's fine. It's good.
Or we ran out of time.
It was good. It was so good.
Oh man, I remember how painful it was to record and mix in that Digi-001.
Oh man, and punch in the Digi-001, right?
Like, yeah.
Yeah, it didn't even work, dude. Like, it didn't even.
It was so tough.
It was better just to do another take.
It was.
Yeah, it was just better to do another take. Like, oh yeah, here's the synth outro. Yeah.
This do you remember what synth this was like? Where I didn't have a synth.
No, you didn't have a synth.
Hey, what do you say, Gordon Shumway?
So I had a MIDI keyboard going through a Sound Blaster Odyssey card, and this is the square lead patch for the Sound Blaster Odyssey card on my MIDI that I brought out for it. And I actually, that's the only synth lead I played as well.
How'd we do the strings for Something Transcendent? I don't remember doing that.
That was also Odyssey. That was also Odyssey. Yeah, and we did a patch for that as well. Didn't you play the line?
Oh, I don't remember.
I think you actually played the line. I started it, but then you had a better idea. Is what I think happened. But yeah, all that was through my Odyssey card. And the reason why the Odyssey was so interesting as a prosumer sound card was it was the first like prosumer device, like the first device that was under $1,000 that supported sound fonts, the old sound font format. All that stuff that you're hearing were sound fonts. Those were all free sound fonts that I downloaded while I was in college. Yeah.
So
that's a deep cut. That is a deep cut.
In the 01, you had what, 24 tracks? Is that right?
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, for the okay. Studio one. Yeah.
So what did your sessions look like?
Well,
they weren't that complex. We only I think the biggest one was 13, right?
Maybe 14, something maybe. Transcendent might be a little more. Probably, let's see, drums would have been like 6 tracks, 7 tracks maybe. So kick, one snare, tom, 2 toms, 2 overheads probably. And then everything would have been just one mic. I had a Rode NT1, still have it, that would have been like the vocal mic and the acoustic guitar and stuff. So six drums, bass, 2 guitars is 9, 2 vocals is 11. Okay, maybe 13 was tops. They weren't crazy.
And all of those vocals were on that NT1?
Probably. I mean, maybe some 57 or something.
All of them were. The only vocals that weren't on the Rode were the phone, and that was just a SM58 into an analog like wire phone.
Landline.
Gotcha.
Yeah, landline. Which was my the voice actress on that is my dear friend Emily, who I'd written a bunch of stuff with throughout college and when I was in high school. And as I recall, I gave her the script earlier in the day, and then we set up the time for her to do the recording, and that was the first take, and we actually did not have to edit anything with the song. Like we just hit the record and with the full intention that we'd like line it up and we'd chop it up and we'd like make it work with the sound of the audio, but it ended up just actually fitting perfectly in the whole thing.
And her read, she does a great job, but her read on, I love, why is it always about finding an answer with you? Like that.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. Like the, oh man, she just killed it. And the pause, like before she says fireflies, I'm like, oh man, it's just such a great intro to the record. And I love, I love bands like Alkaline Trio and, Bad Religion and other bands that will have Leftover Crack does this a lot. Jelly Biafra does this a lot, where there'll be like a voiceover as an intro. Anna Flag does this a lot, where they have a voiceover intro to a song or something like that. And that voiceover intro, I think, is probably the best I'm ever going to get. That one was really, really good. Really hit home.
So Royce, tell me, this is kind of a weird experiment or a weird experience we've set you up in. What's it like to hear this record that we made as almost kids, almost 20 years ago? Now,
I have several different thoughts. One, for sure, it feels way more mature than anything I was doing at 21. I was really kind of blown away by that. And I was trying to think of where I was in 2003 and in 2005 and 2008. And it was just like so drastically of a different space, because I was in hip hop. So that would have been like the height of Jay-Z and Biggie and Pac are dead, like that whole world. And I just can't imagine if I would have walked in the bar and I'd have been like, what the hell is this? You know what I mean? Is happening?
But it feels so. By that, Royce, you mean back then you were playing in front of crowds. people coming to hear your music. Oh, man.
Man. But it sounds, it's weird. It's like, it sounds familiar, though. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if it's like there's so much more music similar to it now. You know what I mean? But it doesn't feel like it's would be out of place in any setting that I could be in today, which is interesting. I like it, man. I like it. I have to give it another listen when I can just get blown away. And I really like to listen when I'm at the studio because I can just hear everything, you know.
You'll hear some stuff.
There's stuff in it. We stuffed it. It's like a turducken. It's a sonic turducken.
If you would have heard my Digi 001 mixes in 2003 in comparison to this, like, it sound like my music sound like ones and zeros. You know what I mean? Like, it just felt so sharp and it hurt. It hurt to listen to. It was difficult. It was tough.
Well, I figured it turned into a good lesson when I did that one day remix in 2005. It really taught me the secret of the 01 is don't do any processing. It's all mics and mic placement, and then don't touch it.
I felt that's how working with the Digi 001 always felt. Like, I always felt like, don't touch it. It might go away.
Well, I remember. I do think a lot does depend on the actual structure, especially for the drums, the structure of the Howard household, right? Like, we have
sure that kitchen hardwood. Actually sounded rad.
It actually sounds really great. Like, you got the hardwood floors, you had high enough ceilings for it to not be like claustrophobic.
Oh, nice.
Like,
how tall are the
drums?
Ceiling?
Did not sound like they weren't in a studio. And I think that, especially for a record this is not a punk record, but it's definitely punk inspired. The drum sound is just so critically important to making it work. And I think in retrospect, you know, especially listening to it tonight, I'm like, wow, the environment had a lot to do with that working.
I keep trying to get those mics back from Scott and he won't give them to me. Those are my favorite drum overheads.
Wow.
Royce, those were Shure PG-81s on the overhead.
Okay.
And I love them. I still want a pair.
There we go.
How tall were the ceilings?
Oh, man. I don't know my architecture.
They were definitely 14 foot, at least.
Oh, okay.
They were pretty tall.
14? No.
Oh, yeah. They were definitely tall. They were definitely tall. I gotta be right back. I've been holding this whole time.
And where did you record the guitars? In the garage?
Well, the acoustics. So at my house, so week one, my house, drums in the kitchen, and then our music room at home, carpeted room, probably maybe 15 feet square or something. That's where we had an upright piano in there, the family computer, which you had back then, you know.
What did you record in there?
That would have been bass, acoustics, and then some of the little bongo part and some stuff, maybe some electric. And then down in Medicine Lodge at Rob's house, we were in the basement, and that would have been vocals, more electric, more acoustic. So the guitars were split between locations.
What was this? What did you have this Digi 001 connected to?
A PC. I had a PC, like, ordered.
So you're moving the whole thing every time.
Sorry?
You're moving the whole setup every time?
Well, yes, but only the once. It lived at my parents' house.
There was not a lot of components then.
Yeah.
Right.
Monitor.
It's not the same as
tower,
it is now.
Tower 01.
Right. That was it. There was just the tower, the 01 monitor, keyboard, and mouse. And we had a monitor, keyboard, and mouse at the place of medicine. So it's different than it is now. Like, you don't have all this ancillary stuff. You don't have, like, capture card. You don't have, like, all this other stuff that has to has to come in. But it, to be fair, it was crazy. It was a totally insane thing to do.
Well, we had nothing else to do. I mean,
yeah.
That's what's up. I guess it's a mobile unit.
Yeah, if you're willing to break it down and move it.
Felt like a LAN party.
LAN parties.
Yeah. When you think back to that year, Howie, one of the questions I wanted to ask you for this was, you think about, like, there were basically like four records that you make in that year that are just, I think, are ones that I return to, you know, frequently in my listening life. Like, did you have a sense that all those were going to be like musical artifacts that you were going to carry with you for a long time?
Not any more than I did about other things. I mean, I think they've stuck with me too, but I think that's because I was in it, you know, and that's, I hope they've stuck with our friends to some extent. And, but they didn't feel more or less significant than what came before or after, really. I mean, Signs and Comets, they each have their own unique thing. Signs and Comets was ambitious in a way.
I would say a big way. Like, that was a big deal. That whole thing was like a really serious accomplishment. Like, that was very significant.
Well, thank you. That means a lot, you know. And then Fireflies is big, became big, right? Like, in the moment, it kind of, in the fall of 2003, I felt kind of disappointed about it because we hadn't gotten it out and I didn't like my mixes and, you know, and, you know, in 2007, I felt frustrated about it because I thought, well, we've got 10 songs that sound decent. Rob, why won't you, you know, let's put them out. Come on. and now it really has become our own like little tiny Chinese democracy. that's, I love that it has this whole story and all these memories and,
it took the same amount of time, but I think there was an inverse relationship between the amount of time it took to release the record and the amount of time it took to record the record to
certainly
Chinese democracy. Yeah. But you know, you think of that Shacker record too, like that, like Part of My Pretension was such a good record. And man, those songs are still some of my favorite songs from that scene. Like Routine and Sophia and like that record was so big.
That's cool. So I'm really partial to the second one, which is little Royce. This is a band I was drumming in, and my friend, it's just another, you know, more friends of mine. My friend Corey was the songwriter and singer. And I really like, I go back to the second Shaka record more than the first one, though I agree completely about the songs. I don't know.
Fair.
Why'd you get a Digi 001? Did you decide you wanted to record everybody's records, or?
Yeah. I appointed myself the, honestly, what all of this started for me. So I loved Fugazi, and I was inspired by Fugazi and Ian MacKaye and the whole DIY thing and straight edge at that time. You know, I wasn't like crazy about straight edge, but I wasn't drinking, and that was an important part of my identity at the time. And so I basically decided I'm going to be the Ian MacKaye of Crete, Nebraska, and I'm going to document my friends' bands, and I'm going to run the label, and I'm going to put out the records, and that's my kind of role model. And basically I've stuck with it.
Yeah, it totally happened. Well, and none of these records would have gotten made otherwise, truthfully.
And I hope, I hope that means something to folks as, you know, as the years pass. And I, well, you know, even whether it does or not, it means a lot to me to have done that, for people to have done this for you, and to that Corey can, you know, play these records for Elliot someday. And I'm
overjoyed.
I hope that people care, you know?
I'm overjoyed that we can hear these songs again, right? In a way that is like true to how the memory of those songs ultimately were. Because just like listening through this now, I'm like, oh man, I forgot that that tune was fun. That tune was a good one. And I can think of the people in the crowd who like that tune was their favorite. And, you know, maybe it wasn't my favorite, but it creates a connection in a very real way that it's easy to forget this stuff. And especially because I was way more focused on performance and getting in front of crowds and performing than I was necessarily from recording. It is such a gift to have memories of what these songs were, and in particular having such a complete representation of all these bands that were playing this weird music in this part of the world. Because a lot of I just think of so many scenes that were probably around our area, and all these musicians that were trying to do the stuff that we were trying to do that probably didn't have a Howie Howard that was seeking to document what was occurring around them, and all that's lost. And that's, you know, that's a real shame. Now it's kind of a different story. You know, the gear is cheaper, the fidelity's higher, the technical expertise that's required is less. Like I think they probably are documenting this now in a way that maybe they weren't before. Like when GarageBand is on every Mac, it's kind of a different story than when you actually had to buy gear to do this stuff. All this, I mean to say, when you talk about, you know, Discord Records being a real source of influence for you, like, a lot of people might assume, because we're talking about this in 2020, that making the analogy to Discord is somewhat superficial because the barriers are a lot lower than it was for them back then. And look, we weren't gluing our records together, right? We weren't pressing them ourselves or anything like that. But we were trying to make music that no one wanted to hear in a place where it's very difficult to continue to be stoked on making it. And we scrapped together the stuff that we needed to do. Like, I think the whole payment for this record was like, I gave you a hard drive.
I have no idea.
I think I paid you for this record with like $50 in a hard drive. that's how this whole thing happened. And that's just kind of representative of where we were at the time. It was not easy to do this back then. And it's really fun to revisit it now.
It makes me happy. Like, you know, at the time I wanted perfection, which I've come to realize is impossible. But what makes me happy is that the performances and the recordings and everything, they're good enough that I feel better about them with time, right? Like as time passes, I hear more of what's good about them, and the imperfections fade. And that, at this stage, that's success for me.
When you recorded back then, how did you feel about it? I mean, I know how you felt as far as like all the technical and all that kind of stuff, but how did you feel about like stepping aside from what you contributed to it?
I don't know if I could. I was so... I identified with it so closely, and I based my sort of self-evaluation so much on the technical achievement or lack of it. It took me a long time to to step back and be able to listen to it and maybe enjoy it, you know?
I will say that the thing that strikes me now, you know, having made a few records since then, we were fighting the gear all the time.
Yeah.
And not just like, not necessarily fighting the gear with respect to amps or mics or anything like that. Like, I think we had everything that was non-digital, with the exception of like the electric guitar amp. I think we were in a pretty good spot. But man, just hearing what you laid down was so painful, because there were so many times where you just hit play and the whole thing would crash. And the force feedback that you get, like the expectation that you have now in the studio, and I'm sure this is true for all the artists that you work with, Royce, is just like, oh, let's just, oh, I got one word wrong, just punch it up.
Right.
And I will say the word and you got to make it sound like it sounds all okay. And obviously that's not trivial to do now, but back then it was impossible. But even just to hit play, to hear what you just did was a real struggle. I think one of the things we didn't take into consideration with the amount of, or one of the things I think was a technical achievement with accomplishing this in 2 weeks, was we got a sound that we were happy with for everything in 2 weeks. And then we also tracked it all. Like, yeah, that was,
and those were long days, and we had, yeah, we had fun days at the end of them. I couldn't do yeah, it now.
Yeah.
But those were long days.
Yeah, they were rough. They were rough. I don't think there was a single day that was under 12 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we would go and like play a show, or we'd go to a friend of our show. Yeah, it was ridiculous. It's ridiculous thinking about it now.
Don't even have that same kind of energy, huh? Man, wow. That's pretty cool, man. You know, you guys captured a moment in your lives that you were able to go back to all those memories and listen to it.
That's really,
I guess that's what music is, but
that's really what it's like. What's special about this record for me, listening to it now, is that the memories of making it are so intense. Mm. Unlike any record I've made. And it's great to have, my memory's not super great, so it's really special to have some clear, you know, specific memories from 2003 with Rob, because I don't have a lot of memories like that. It kind of gets fuzzy.
It's fuzzy.
Yeah. But it was also interesting to capture this in a moment of, you know, significant transition for both of us, right? Like, you know, you're entering your senior year, I'm exiting my senior year, and basically everything for us was starting in that year in a big way.
And, huge pivot.
You know, when I think about our reach at that time, and when I think about some of the other records you worked on during that period, when I think about just the mentality that we all had, everybody that was on Mr. Furious at the time, you know, it was a special group, because we all had just astronomic ambition. Like, we all felt like we were going to go out there and we were going to do something huge. And music was somehow going to be a part of it. And, you know, having a documentary record that reflects that ambition is just such a treasure. And, man, it was a really special thing. And I'm deeply grateful, Howie, for not only you doing it, but also digging it up this year of all years for us to explore together, because it's a very timely reminder of the ambition that we all had during that time, we can all, and that we all need today.
Couldn't say it better.
This is on Bandcamp now, or is it going to be on Bandcamp?
It's by the time people can hear this show, it's on Bandcamp. It's on all the big streaming platforms: Spotify, Tidal, Apple Music, YouTube, Deezer. Forgetting one.
It will be wherever you want to listen to quality music. You will also be able to listen to Arturo Got the Shafts. Life Without Flyer. And we would, of course, love to hear what you think about it. You can find me at rob@brooklynhacker.com, and I would love to hear what you have to say about it.
Awesome. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Royce.
Absolutely.
All right.
We'll talk to everybody later.
Woo! LP!